Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks by the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Rita Dove. Dove's debut book of poetry, The Yellow House in the Corner, was praised for its sense of history and attention to detail. She went on to write the verse novel Thomas and Beulah, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and On the Bus with Rosa Parks, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. In praise of Dove, poet Brenda Shaughnessy has said, quote, "She is a master at transforming a public or historic element, revisioning a spectacle and unearthing the heartfelt, wildly original private thoughts such historic moments always contain." In addition to her publications, Dove is known for advocacy for the arts. She was named U.S. Poet Laureate in 1993, making her the youngest poet and the first African-American to hold this title. She took the post seriously, traveling around the country to give readings and generate interest in the literary arts. In 2011, she served as the editor of the Penguin Anthology of 20th Century American Poetry and generated controversy and dialogue through her choices for the collection. In this recording, Dove is now honored with Oregon State University's 2016 Stone Award. The Stone Award, for Lifetime Literary Achievement, honors a major American author who has created a body of critically acclaimed literary work and has been a dedicated mentor to succeeding generations of young writers. Now, from the 2016 Stone Award event, here is Rita Dove speaking in front of a live audience at the First Congregational Church in Portland.
I have had to work hard to pare things down, to think about what's essential for me and possibly what might be interesting to a broad audience of poetry lovers, students, people at all stages in their studies, their careers. And I would like to start by, first of all, sharing how terribly moved I am by the character of Beulah in Thomas and Beulah. And I think it's because she reminds me so much of all of the talented women in my family who left little trace, actually, and whose stories are now unrecoverable because they have passed away and didn't achieve the visible or readable or viewable vestiges that they might have left behind. And when I first read Thomas and Beulah, it was an incredible inspiration to me, and I felt as if I was actually reading a compendium of your family history set within a larger American story. But I always would wonder, like, was Thomas really wearing a yellow scarf? And if your family member read this book, one of your extended family's members, you'd be, I remember that scarf. and is the book in some ways a lovely familial museum, a recording of or bringing together of all kinds of tidbits and stories and objects and things to preserve them? Because these things vanish so quickly from a family. They're like the soul of a family. Once the family members pass away, they vanish often and cannot be recovered. Are there things in the book that your family would recognize and that in some ways you put in there to please them, to enforce the idea that all, even the most ordinary detail from the family history is precious?
When I assigned the first book that I got to my mother, I remember writing it as a dedication, you know, for Mom, who's the only person who knows what's real or not in here, because she really was the hidden author in that book. Mm-hmm. She gave me her memories gladly and without judgment, and I changed them, you know, sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the essence of it was never changed. There were stories which, and situations which never changed. And one of the most moving for me experiences was to have one of my aunts come up to me after I read in Akron, Ohio, which is terrifying. You're reading a book about your family in front of your family. And she said, "I remember that scene." She was referring to one scene when my grandfather had a stroke but had recovered. She said, "I remember that so well, you know, how that happened, and he was, and thank you for this."
Mm-hmm. And she probably was very struck and amazed by how accurately, really, or how much you were really able to call it up, even though you were not yourself present. And I think that's one of the magic aspects of poetry. And you're you know, being able to create an entire world like that and recreate a marriage is an act of almost conjuration. I wanted to talk about magic, in fact, because your poems do feature often, especially in, well, all throughout your work, but in Thomas and Beulah, ideas of powerful magic or transformations that are even scary in their intensity. And one of the poems I wanted to ask you to read is from Beulah's childhood. It's the poem Magic. Uh-huh. This poem both has that delightful aspect of childlike innocence and a very terrifying level in which we understand that the magic is quite serious. The need to deceive and to create illusion is quite serious.
Ah, yes. Magic. Practice makes perfect, the old folk said. So she rehearsed deception until ice cubes dangled willingly from a plain white string, and she could change an egg into her last nickel. Sent to the yard to sharpen, she bent so long over the wheel, the knives grew thin. When she stood up, her brow shorn clean as a wheat field and stippled with blood, she felt nothing, even when Mama screamed. She fed sauerkraut to the apple tree. The apples bloomed tartar every year. Like all art, useless and beautiful, like sailing in air, things happened to her. One night she awoke, and on the lawn blazed a scaffolding strung in lights. Next morning, the Sunday paper showed the Eiffel Tower soaring through clouds. It was a sign she would make it to Paris one day.
The word deception is sometimes considered a negative word, mm-hmm. but here it has a power. I was going to ask you to talk a little bit about what you meant there by deception. Whom is she deceiving? Is it partly about self-deception? Because one of the interesting things that's hard to figure about this poem is she deliberately refusing to acknowledge the cross in the yard? Mm-hmm. Or is she transforming it in an imaginative way simply because that's what she does? That's her power. Or is she simply innocent of it?
Ah, all of these questions come to play. I think that children watch the adults and they watch the world so they can figure out how to navigate it. And young women, particularly young women, you know, during my grandmother's time, learned that you had to hide it if you were smart, if you, you had to be docile. And so deception becomes a really necessary way of survival in the world. And that's one level of the deception. On a very basic level, of course, she's practicing magic tricks because they're kind of like a symbol of all the kind of deceptions we can do. And to think that it's just how you look at something sometimes mm-hmm. is the way you can manage it. She's doing something that I think a lot of people here have never really done, and that is to sharpen knives using a grinding wheel, and she bends too far over it, and you kind of shaves off of her forehead, something that happened actually to my mother.
I was going to ask yes. if that. I just that wanted to ask badly if that's a real story.
It happened to my mother, and she said, you know, it was just so miraculous. I didn't even feel anything. And mm-hmm. But to Beulah, it's sort of like, you cannot feel if you don't want to. If you choose not to for a long time, you don't have to feel. Mm-hmm. So in the end, when she has this dream, or when she sees the lights on the lawn, she decides it's going to be Paris. That's mm-hmm. where she wants to be. Mm-hmm. And she can live her life with that dream. Mm-hmm. You know?
And later she goes on to be a kind of an artist in the sense she's a creator of wearable sculptures known as hats.
Hats.
Beautiful hats. Would you read Headdress for us, actually?
Sure.
Because that's
my grandmother
also my
did make hats. She mm-hmm. made the most amazing hats, and I wish hats would come back. It was one of women's best weapon. Headdress. The hat on the table in the dining room is no pet trained to sit still. Three pearl-tipped spears and Beulah maneuvering her shadow to the floor. The hat is cold. The hat wants more. The customer will be generous when satisfied beyond belief. spangled tulle then in green and gold and cherry. Beulah would have settled for less. She doesn't pray when she's terrified, sometimes inside her skin, like today, humming through a mouthful of pins. Finished, it's a mountain on a dish, a capital poised on a littered shore. The brim believes in itself, its double rows and feathers a shiver. Extravagance redeems. Oh, intimate parasol that teaches to walk with grace along beauty's scene.
So there's a kind of another act, a circus act, almost a tightrope walk at the end.
Well, how can you walk that line and keep up your belief in beauty, your belief in love, and still have a joy in life?
I wanted to ask you about whether she represents for you an artist in the sense, I've often wondered if this book is, in a sense, an attempt to map or trace your origins, how it is that you arose out of this family as a poet and a maker and a creator, based on these powerful women.
The women in my family were all incredibly creative within the sphere, the small sphere that they had. My grandmother, those hats were artistic landscapes, and she would, I would watch her study the woman, and she would, because I was about 12 at that time, and so she would tell me about the woman who wanted the hat. And she goes, oh, you know, this woman, you know, she's got to hide that mole on her head. So, okay, we'll do that. But, you know, the hat's really too top heavy. But
she was perfecting the women, too. So she was editing them.
Exactly. She was saying, you know, she's a little bit hefty, so I'm going to give her a hat that is going to give her weight and balance. This is all, great. It was so beautiful to hear this little monologue going on as she went on and made these amazing, amazing hats. And my mother sewed. She was a seamstress. I mean, every woman in the family was a seamstress. You had to be. There were no, you just didn't go out and buy ready-made clothes. You made your clothes. But that's where they poured in their artistry. And it mattered. And it made them happy. I grew up knowing how to sew. And whenever I get stressed, that's where I go.
Sewing makes me stressed out.
Oh, really?
So that's remarkable to me. I think because I think of it as something requiring a lot of accuracy and perfection, not my strong suit.
But you see, no one sees the seams.
What I love about the hat-making poem is that you reveal the process, right? Not only the mental process, but some of the physical process. And I find that much of your work explores process, creative process. One of the most enigmatic poems for me in On the Bus with Rosa Parks is The Musician Talks About Process. First of all, I'd like you to read it.
Okay.
And then I'd like to know how you became interested in this person.
Okay. The Musician Talks About Process. I learned the spoons from my grandfather, who was blind. Every day he'd go into the woods because that was his thing. He met all kinds of creatures, birds and squirrels, and while he was feeding them, he'd play the spoons. And after they finished, they'd stay and listen. When I go into Philly on a Saturday night, I don't need nothing but my spoons and the music. Laid out on my knees, they look so quiet, but when I pick them up, I can play to anything. A dripping faucet, a tambourine, fish shining in a creek. A funny thing. When my grandfather died, every creature sang. And when the men went out to get him, they kept singing. They sung for 2 days, all the birds, all the animals. That's when I left the South.
So the enigma here is, well, first of all, I'd love to hear you talk about how you became interested in this person, this musician. And I know that listening to jazz and blues has been extremely important to your process as you've composed poems for multiple collections. So I thought it would be interesting to hear you talk about the influence of that musical tradition on your writing. And
I had discovered him really actually through it was a television program. And they just interviewed him. He wasn't even the main source of the television program. I don't even remember what it was anymore, except he just described how he played the spoons. And he pretty much did say, you know, I can just play to anything, and he had come up from the South. Underlying the poem, of course, is an incredibly dramatic and tragic event with his grandfather, and he just alludes to it. He says he dies, and you think, okay. And then he said, well, the men went out to get him, and you
say, that's the mystery.
What? You know, why do they have to go out to get him? And then he says, that's when I left the South. And it alludes to a lynching. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't go there. He
it's just extremely plays delicate spoons.
And puts it all into that. It's in a way it's sort of that he cannot bear to talk about it, but he can put it into his music.
Right, and in some ways he takes the grandfather's gift with him as he leaves the South. I was interested in the spoons being such a household item, such a domestic item, and this idea that you can make music with anything seems very consistent with your ideas of poetry and how poetry is not exalted, but is made out of the language of ordinary life, in a sense. And that's very much true of this poem, which doesn't have a high flute and vocabulary or anything, but
it's
a
very
simple story told very directly.
The challenge of the poem was also to tell it very simply, not to use any highfaluting words, and just but still have it sing. Yeah.
One of the less frequent points of view that we tend to see, and I'm speaking here as a teacher partly, is we-driven poems. We don't see much first-person plural often, and I think it takes a great deal of confidence to write a first-person plural poem because you're speaking for a group, and you have taken that takes some audacity. But I wanted to ask you to read a poem that uses the first-person plural in a really quite lovely, humble way, and in a very inclusive way, because it kind of goes against the grain of what we think of the we-driven poem or the first-person plural, and that's in the lobby of the Warner Theater, Washington, D.C.
Yes, okay. I'll tell you a little bit about it before I read it. This poem is out of a sequence of poems called On the Bus with Rosa Parks, which is also the title of this book. And the scene you're going to see is, I think you'll even recognize the director, but Rosa Parks has been brought to the theater to see this film about civil rights. I'll just read it now. In the lobby of the Warner Theater, Washington, D.C. They'd positioned her, two attendants flanking the wheelchair, at the foot of the golden escalator, just right of the movie director who had cajoled her to come. Elegant in a high-strung way, a twitch in his tux, he shoved half spectacles up the non-existent bridge of his nose. Not that he was using her to push his film, but it was only right, wasn't it, that she be wherever history was being made. After all, she was the true inspiration. She was living history. The audience descended in a cavalcade of murmuring sequence. She waited. She knew how to abide, to sit in cool contemplation of the expected. She had learned to travel a crowd bearing a smile we weren't sure we could bear to receive. It was so calm, a suturing. Scrolling earthward, buffed bronze in the reflected glow, we couldn't wait, but leaned out to catch a glimpse and saw that the smile was not practiced at all. Real delight bloomed there. She was curious. She suffered our approach, the gush and coo, the babbling, the director bending down to meet the camera flash, until someone tried to touch her, and then the attendants pushed us back gently. She nodded, lifted a hand as if to console us before letting it drop slowly to her lap. Resting there, the idea of consolation soothing us, her gesture already become her touch, like the history she made for us sitting there, waiting for the moment to take her.
It's such it's hard to describe, but you have an amazing gift for stripping away the iconicity of the figure. Mm. But the speaker expects her to be an icon too, so yes. The self, the speaker, strips away her own expectation, but also shows this, again, this magical of power that Rosa Parks has to be both genuine and a symbol.
And a symbol at the same time. It must have, I think I am in some way obsessed with the whole idea of what constitutes, an icon or a historical icon and the real person beneath that or the real persons beneath that. Because, of course, she's also standing up and out for everyone who wants to touch her. And yet she is a human being who is probably tired.
Right.
Doesn't want to be touched.
And but extremely gracious at the same time.
And for me, I mean, that is based kind of on it's based on a real event. And where I was at a place where Rosa Parks was kind of brought in like that. And I was transported by her grace in that situation because she was old, she was tired, she was being overwhelmed by this, and yet she didn't let it overwhelm her. And the poem becomes, for me, honoring that, what she did.
There's many other we poems in your collections. You may not have noticed this about your work.
I never noticed it, no.
Oh, but it's quite wonderful. Yeah. I wanted to know if you would read Black on a Saturday Night, because it is one of my favorite poems from this collection. The rhythms are so intoxicating, the exhilarating sense of enthusiasm is so wonderful here. It's a we-driven poem, and for obvious reasons, it is not my we, but I still feel extremely engaged by it and included by it. Would you?
I'll be happy to, yes, yes. Black on a Saturday Night. This is no place for lilac or somebody on a trip to themselves. Hips are an asset here, and color calculated to flash lemon bronze cerise in the course of a dip and turn. Beauty's been caught lying and the truth rubbed raw. Here you get your remorse as a constitutional right. It's always what we don't fear that happens. Always not now and why are you people acting this way? Meaning we put in petunias instead of hydrangeas and reject ecru as a fashion statement. But we can't do it. No, because the wages of living are sin, and the wages of sin are love, and the wages of love are pain, and the wages of pain are philosophy, and that leads definitely to an attitude, and an attitude will get you nowhere fast, so you might as well keep dancing, dancing till tomorrow gives up with a shout, because there is only Saturday night, and we are in it. Black as black can, black as black does, not a concept nor a percentage, but a natural law. Now, thank you. I have to tell you the background to that one.
Do.
I will, because it actually comes, the title comes from a white man who reflected on, he grew up in the South, and it was a program on PBS, and he reflected on listening to black musicians in a segregated auditorium. And he said all the whites were sitting on the ground floor, and of course in the so-called peanut gallery, all the blacks were there. And except, he said, sometimes if a black group came to play, now you have a problem because the black group is on the stage and you can't have the whites on the same level or in the same space. So all the whites were put up in there. And then all the blacks are down here. He said, I would sit up there and I would hear this great music and I would think, oh, it must be wonderful to be black on a Saturday night. And of course I thought, black on a Saturday night, what about the other 6 days of the week? But the thing just stuck in my head.
Right.
And so I wanted to get that in.
I wanted to shift to talking a little bit about your verse play.
Okay.
Which is a powerful, I don't know how many people in the audience have read it, but it's an overwhelmingly emotionally powerful experience to read it. But I wanted to ask primarily about your experience of seeing it produced and how that made you feel as a poet, because we poets are not used to turning our work over to a director and to a set of actors and costume designers and so forth, and having them interpret it so tangibly and actively as to stage it. I know it was powerful for you, but how it felt to sort of give up some control over your own work and see a vision be developed out of it.
Well, you know that poets work in isolation, where we love our solitude and the hours will go by. And there comes a point where you maybe will stand up in front of someone and read it, but there's also a feeling of intimacy with the audience. And in theater, it's a different kind of intimacy, but it's not my creation. They take my words and they create it. And I never felt more helpless than when the lights went down on the premiere and before they went up again. I thought, I can't do a thing. I just couldn't do a thing. But on the other hand, what I thought was incredible was to hear these words that I had imagined being spoken and acted, embodied by these actors who really would come up to me, and I was lucky enough to be there for a workshop for 3 weeks, and then the next year for the performance beforehand, for 3 weeks of the rehearsals. And they would come up to me and say, you know, what do you think Skylla eats when she's in her cabin alone? And I'm like, oh, yeah, you know. And so then we talked about it, and I realized that they were building an entire.
Yes.
They were building that character.
And you are the god of that universe, so you can determine what she had.
What she had, you know. Yeah, and I said, well, no. What do you think she? No, no. What I mean was, it was really incredible because they wanted to bring that story, and I realized that one of the things that is magical about theater, that poetry tries to do in the bend of the words, is that you embody the thoughts, everything that's unspoken through gesture. You have to show it in your body. And so she wanted to know basically what Skylla had eaten so she would know how full she felt and how she moved.
And how much energy she had.
How much energy she had, all of these kinds of things. And I realized as a poet that's what I would try to do when I would write poetry. I would try to give words flesh so that they would move on the page and so that the reader would breathe it. I also felt like I had an incredible family. Mm-hmm. It was a family. We had been through fire together. We had gone through this rehearsal period, and the play is basically a retelling of the Oedipus Rex story, but on a slave plantation. And this was being done in Ashland, Oregon. And it was the first time they had had a really, really quite a race-specific play in quite a while. We didn't know how the audience was going to take it. And I still remember right before we went out on they went on a stage. I see we. I wasn't going out on stage, but I felt like I was going out on
Your
stage.
Your words went out.
Yes. And we were backstage in a circle, and somebody said, I don't know if we're going to make it out of this alive, but we're going in there. And then off we went. And we had to laugh. And then off we went. But I realized how much of a hermit a poet can be and how wonderful it was to have all of these incredibly artistic and creative people working for this one piece. On the other hand, I've never felt anything more terrifying than not being in control.
Mm-hmm. And did you find that having written a verse play altered or changed or modified the way that you write generally? Was it easy for you to do the verse to the play?
It felt easy. Mm-hmm. It felt like this was what the next step that poetry can do. I took to it. I really loved it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because of that. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because I want the words to dance, too, on the stage. Mm-hmm. So I really did enjoy doing it. And what I learned in that experience at Oregon Shakespeare was how to write so that it couldn't, well, it can always be mistaken and misdone. Mm-hmm. Anything can be. But how to write to prevent as much of that as possible. Mm-hmm. So it was a fantastic learning experience. Since then, the play has been performed many times. And before the play got to Oregon Shakespeare, it had a couple of staged readings, which is really when a bunch of actors get on stage and they don't, sometimes they walk some things out, but it's mostly read and they have scripts in hand. And it's a way of working over the script. And the 92nd Street Y in New York had wanted to do a staged reading of the play. Fred had actually talked with Derek Walcott. Derek Walcott was a wonderful poet, but also a fantastic playwright. And he had challenged several of his fellow Nobel laureates, you know, poets like Joseph Brodsky and Seamus Heaney, and to write a play. He challenged all of them to write a play, and several of them did. And Fred said to Derek, "Oh, Rita has a play, you know, you really should read it, Fred." I love my husband. He's wonderful. And Derek said, "I'll direct it at the Y." The play was, at that point, 2.5 to 3 hours long. And the Y only does things up to 90 minutes. So Derek said, "Cut it in half, and I'll see you in about 3 weeks, and we'll
no
go
problem.
Over this."
No problem. You just take your pie crust and you just trim it, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the kind of rigor, you know, that right. sometimes, you know. So I had to think, how can I make it into 90 minutes? Mm-hmm. And so that taught me something about tightening it up. He says, "You can always put it back in." So I, you know, but, and I didn't put it all back in, but I put some of it back in. And then I was having a problem with this play because I couldn't get, I said, how do you speak your inner thoughts? We do it in poetry all the time,
right.
But this is a play.
How do you do it realistically, yeah, like in the setting with theater?
And he suddenly said, "It's an aria. It's an aria. Think of it as an aria. Don't think of it as a monologue. Think of it as an aria." And that, it was this funny little click. He knew I loved music, and so I thought, "Oh yeah, I can do an aria." And then after the play, I began to think more of some of these poems as arias.
Arias. That's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. That was a departure, but I've been told by sources who know that you have other plays, one-act plays and so forth, held in reserve, and in fact, you have a hold-in-reserve policy generally. It seems like you have a large and rich bank of fragments and pieces and things like that. And will we see another play from you? Is this something that might happen?
I hope it will happen. I hope it will happen. We'll see it.
Yeah, eventually. I've heard you're getting a little pressure from in the domestic sphere,
I am,
too.
Yeah,
it's probably useful. I've heard you say that every new book that you've written, you wanted to start a new project, a departure, something that
yes.
didn't just repeat what happened before. And for instance, in Thomas and Beulah, you used only the third person, although to create extraordinary intimacy. You had a linear narrative, and you wanted to break away from that and do something else and really stretch yourself. You did a collection, Mother Love, which is based on the sonnet. So sometimes you set yourself a verse form to give structure to that. I was wondering if you have poetic superstitions, though, and want to make sure that there is some connection between each collection that you create so that they are not sort of going out into, as orphans, or in other words, that they're all holding hands and maybe giving a ladder rung to each other, because I do notice that things recur. For instance, in On the Bus with Rosa Parks, there's this beautiful series of cameos about the six sisters, and then the sisters reappear
in
American Smooth in the Swan Song.
Yes.
And so I felt, I almost feel like there is a desire to honor that former material and say, "I still am connected to you. I'm not letting go of you. I'm attached to you." And I wondered if you'd read actually this the sisters' swan song.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sisters' swan song. We died one by one, each plumper than the mirror saw us. We exited obligingly, rattling keychains and cocktail jewelry, rehearsing our ghostly encores. Glad to be rid of pin curls and prayers, bunions burning between ironed sheets, we sang our laments, praised God, and went our way quietly. We're mourned in satin and chrysanthemums, whiskey and cake, old gossip evaporating into cautionary tales. Does it matter who went first, Corinna or Faye, heartache or coronary, a reckless scalpel or a careless life? Whoever was left kept count on the dwindling rosary. Susanna, Kit, Mary, Violet, Pearl. We all died of insignificance.
That last line is so heartbreaking. But it's interesting to me that in the cameos, these are young women. They're having their children. They're raising their children and so on. And then here you give them a eulogy. As if that's the proper thing to do. And I just see so many strong connections between your collections in that way, where there's this incredible tender respectfulness toward what came before and a desire to say, you're not excluded. Mm-hmm. I'm doing something else, but I'm going to include some of you because you're part of the making of me. I'm bringing you forward. Is that something that you might find valuable?
Yes, I mean, it was the way my family lived. I mean, I felt there was an enormous sacrifice that was being not, you know, flaunted or anything like that, but it was taking place in the family structure. My father was one of many, many children, and he was the one that they decided was the smart one, and so his sisters would do things like, you know, unravel their sweaters and knit him socks so that he could go to school, so that he could help the rest of the family, which he did, you know, without any kind of fanfare, but he was always there for them to help people through. And I pieced all of that together. He didn't tell me, because he would never tell me. He would have never. This is just what you do.
Right.
If you have a family and if you love them. And so this, I feel that I'm not always aware that I'm taking things from one book to the next, but
I love it
can't
because,
let them go.
Yeah, I love that, though, because I feel like I'm reading in one enormous, rich collection, not lots of individuals, although they're very different from each other. I love to re-encounter those people from earlier collections, and I thought this idea is very fascinating about it, choosing and advancing a person from a family at sacrifice, at significant sacrifice. But you are extremely rigorous in your exploration of fear. And mother love, I think, takes on the subject of fear at its core in a way that this mother can really identify with the sense of powerlessness of a mother to protect her child, of all of the frightening and really horrible things that can happen to a child out in the world. It doesn't have to be a daughter, of course, right?
But it can
not
be,
by any means. That's why I think people can relate to it. Would you read Persephone Falling? This doesn't use the word fear, but every time I read it, a chill just passes through my entire body.
Sure. Persephone Falling. One narcissus among the ordinary beautiful flowers, one unlike all the others. She pulled, stooped to pull harder, when, sprung out of the earth on his terrible, glittering carriage, he claimed his due. It is finished. No one heard her. No one. She had strayed from the herd. Remember, go straight to school. This is important. Stop fooling around. Don't answer to strangers. Stick with your playmates. Keep your eyes down. This is how easily the pit opens. This is how one foot sinks into the ground.
So what motivates you to face that kind of fear head on and write about it?
I think by facing it, or not trying to conquer it, but by facing it and entering it, I feel a little less afraid of it. I feel like I'm getting to know the fear. I mean, half of fear, well, half of anything is the fear of the unknown, but you can even fear fear. And I remember when my daughter was born, and my mother came out, and I had this little baby, and she was crying, wouldn't stop. And I burst into tears, and I said, I can't protect her. That's all. I was kind of weeping in a corner. Fred was like, you know, trying to console. And my mother said, what's going on? And he says, I don't know. You better go into your daughter. I said, I can't protect her. And she just looked at me and she said, no, you can't. Now get back out there and take care of that baby. I mean, that's basic. She was saying, yes, this is the fear, and you can do what you can do. Mm-hmm. Which used to take care of the baby. So when I began writing these poems, yes, there's some scary stuff in there. I mean, the biggest fear is to lose, I think, a child. And I think the myth also helped me, though, deal with the fear.
Mm-hmm. You often use fabric terms, the textures and the types of fabric, in poems that have nothing to do with fabric. Like, for instance, in the very first poem in Thomas and Beulah, The Water Shures, which is a fabric term for mm-hmm. that kind of tucking, that very fine tucking and pleating that happens in fabric. So I'm very interested in hearing you talk a little bit about fabric, texture, cloth, sewing, but more of a costume, because that's been so much of an element of your writing, both in, I think it was probably an attraction in writing a play, too, is to think about the sumptuousness of costume and set design, but also mostly in Sonata Melodica. Mm-hmm. Costume is an enormous feature of that collection. Well, and yeah. I was going to ask if you would read a book from Sonata Melodica called The Wardrobe Lesson, which is a remarkable piece of advice from a father to a son on the importance of costume.
Yes, because after all, as human beings, we have this ability to adorn ourselves. You know, we just don't have plumage and then get rid of it or molt. We can choose our costume, and it is another form of both of lure and deception.
Deception.
And negotiation. A little backstory on this. This story is this poem. A father is talking to his son. His son is the father calls himself the African prince. He dresses in outlandish clothes. This is the 18th century, late 18th century. And he's milking people's idea of the exotic. So he is now telling his son, who's about to embark on a career as a young prodigy violinist, what to do. The wardrobe lesson. And they're in England, I should say. I should say that they're in England where it's rainy and it's dark and no one's wearing any color, much less have they ever seen someone of their color. The wardrobe lesson. Everyone in this brown soused village believes an African loves color. So let it be red for our promenade along the Steine, with a splash of yellow to inflame their watery sensibilities. I think it's the sun they so yearn for. Blue saddens this close to the sea, though turquoise is beckoning, and emerald is best a hue entertained only in furnishings. True, we are props of a sort. Let's not forget it. Yet what an aspect we'll project unleashed among the masses. Against our darker palette, any color thrills. The main thing is fabric and plenty of it, clouds of silk, waves of damask to be cast off or furled neat to the chest with a certain sly emphasis. You'll learn these sophistications in time. For now, it's enough to remember we are here to confound them, these wizened polyps crossing the sands in their creaking bathing machines. So, bright sashes and billowing sleeves, rings on as many fingers as you dare, perhaps a turban or some other headdress to lend majesty without competing. The ladies adore a cape. Different from a cloak, this you can wear inside, where one brisk swirl will conjure a fable of perfumed trysts and moonlit swordplay. As for the embroidered slippers, ungainly as they might seem, the upturned toes do not emasculate. Each step becomes necessarily deliberate, and so recalls the boudoir. Don't flinch. It won't do to ignore what waits behind each smile, that unvoiced sigh accompanying your every tremolo. Go ahead, examine those upturned faces in the concert hall, their tiny gasps and glistening cheeks. I've seen it, boy, even for one young as you. Ah, the ladies are always bored and lonely. You will not need a horse if you have a cape. He was a character.
Yeah.
He was a character.
Yeah. This poem seems immensely contemporary in some way, right?
It's true.
Because, you know, everyone manipulates stereotypes of others and or themselves or whatever group they belong to some on occasion to an advantage. And it's a source, it can be a source of power. But it's, the poem also makes you a little uneasy because we feel a little bit like we are being had, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And we deserve it.
And we deserve it.
Which
on
makes
all
us
sides,
feel
yes.
even more interesting things, right? So I feel like this is a huge subject, but this is going to be made into a documentary film, right? Sonata Melodica.
Yes, that? Yes, they
and
are.
And it features a 23 or 4-year-old prodigy violinist.
Yes,
is that,
wonderful.
Can you tell us a little
wonderful
bit about
young man.
That project?
Well, the project is being done by Spark Media, a wonderful film company coming out of Baltimore and DC sometimes. And what they want to not only dramatize the story, because it is a remarkable story of a mixed-race violinist who Beethoven had composed one of his sonatas for and then tore up the dedication later so that he basically dropped right out of history again, this violinist. But the idea is also to relate it to draw that thread from the 18th century all the way up to the 21st century of what of another young black violin prodigy and how he has been able to make his way through the world. And so we discovered this wonderful man, young man, and it's a mix, it's a collage. It flashes back between the George Bridge Tower on the one hand and this young man in contemporary life, so it's been, and it's just wonderful to hear him develop. And
that is scheduled to come out in 2017, is that right?
So.
You know, have you been very involved in the production of it, or the?
I've been involved in the sense that I did read poems. I've been talking about they're going to cut in pieces for me, so it's a documentary as well. I've met the young man. He's played at my house. We've talked about things and. He came with me to a poetry reading once, and he played, you know, while I read.
It's
been wonderful because I've got a chance to meet him as well.
We're nearing the end of our time, but I thought we could end with a poem, which I've always felt drops over me like a mantle of protection. And I think that's a fitting way to end because it just feels like a blessing. And we are blessed to have you here speaking so generously about your process and your experiences as a writer. And the poem is testimonial.
Ah, testimonial. Sure. Testimonial. Back when the earth was new and heaven just a whisper. Back when the names of things hadn't had time to stick. Back when the smallest breezes melted summer into autumn, when all the poplars quivered sweetly in rank and file. The world called, and I answered. Each glance ignited to a gaze. I caught my breath and called that life, swooned between spoonfuls of lemon sorbet. I was pirouette and flourish. I was filigree and flame. How could I count my blessings when I didn't know their names? Back when everything was still to come, luck leaked out everywhere. I gave my promise to the world, and the world followed me here. Thank you.
Thank you, Rita Dove.
Thank you.
That was Rita Dove speaking at the First Congregational Church in Portland during the 2016 Stone Award event. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. Theme music for the Archive Project is by Emancipator. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.